Welcome to another edition of the Progressive Forum. The Progressive Forum covers issues such as human rights, the environment, politics, and peace and justice, in addition to presenting news, commentary, and a weekly calendar of events.
This is KPFT 90.1 Pacifica Radio in Houston. The program's a Progressive Forum. I'm Wally James. Coming up on tonight's show, our first guest is Beau Grosskopf, and he is the author of several books. The one we're going to be focusing on tonight is Strategic Terror, Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment. And at 8 o'clock, Lillian Kerr is going to be here, and she's going to be doing an interview with Barbara Ransby. She's the author of a new book, Islanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. And then we're going to end it with an interview with Juan Gonzalez, co-host with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! He's also co-director of the new film, Harvest of Empire, the untold story of Latinos in America. And that film's going to be here in Houston tomorrow night, and one of the producers is going to be there for a Q&A, so you might want to stick around for that. We're going to start things off with This Week in History and a commentary by Matt Rothschild. Now for This Week in History, on May 4th, 1886, the Haymarket Massacre in Chicago kills 11 and wounds almost 200. On May 1st, 1890, the first International Labor Day was celebrated. On May 2nd, 1896, U.S. troops intervene in Nicaragua. On April 29th, 1950, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom is founded. On May 2nd, 1924, the U.S. Supreme Court upholds the institutional sterilization of mentally retarded people. On May 1st, 1960, an American U-2 spy plane is shot down over the Soviet Union. On April 28th, 1965, U.S. Marines land in the Dominican Republic to support a military junta. On May 2nd, 1968, the Poor People's Campaign march in Washington, D.C. On April 30th, 1970, President Richard Nixon announces the invasion of Cambodia. And 4 days later, on May 4th, 1970, the Ohio National Guard kills 4 students at Kent State University. That's This Week in History. This information comes from the calendar, The Hidden History of the United States. Up next, we have Matt Rothschild.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. On May 1st, there were pro-immigrant rallies in more than 100 cities across the country. It is just these kinds of rallies and the courageous efforts of the Dreamers that have brought the American public around on this issue. According to the latest New York Times CBS News poll, a whopping 83% of the American public favors comprehensive immigration reform that would at last give the 11 million undocumented people in this country a path to citizenship if they pay fines and back taxes and pass a criminal background check and learn English. Like the gay and lesbian rights movement, the immigrant cause has been helped enormously by people coming out of the closet. I'm thinking of Jose Antonio Vargas, the Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post writer who went public as someone who was here illegally but still making a big contribution. And I'm thinking of all those young people who call themselves dreamers, who have, at great risk to themselves and to their families, gone public with their own stories. Many of them came over as little kids and have lived here essentially their whole lives. This is their country, too, and most Americans accept that. Just as we accept the fact that someone who's worked here for many, many years ought to be able to finally become a citizen and not self-deport, as Mitt Romney so infamously put it. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
This is KPFT, 90.1 Pacifica Radio. The program is a progressive forum. I'm Wally James. Our first guest tonight is Beau Grosskopf. He is a professor of international relations at California State University, Chino. He is author of several books on terrorism, including Strategic Terror, Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment. His latest writing is Cluster Munitions and State Terrorism for the Monthly Review Press. Beau, welcome to the Progressive Forum.
Thank you very much, Wally. That's Chico, not Chino.
I'm sorry.
Chino is the prison.
Well, you definitely don't want to be teaching in a prison, probably. Well, let's go ahead and get things started. We had the bombing in Boston at the Marathon, and things have settled down a little bit since then. And I would like you to look back on it and give us your thoughts in a little bit of retrospection.
Sure. I think that there have been some important things that have come out of the bombing and the aftermath that American citizens should take to account. One is, I think, that we saw clear evidence of the militarization of law enforcement in this country. We know where our tax dollars have been going now, to all the toys and other aspects of a militarized police. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, that's up to your listeners to decide, but it certainly is happening along with the total militarization of our society. I think another thing that is important to look at is the response to the capture of the one remaining suspect, and that is, you know, the typical response of, it's over. This new experience of being locked down, having to spend some time with my dog in the bathtub, and then finally I'm allowed to go out and enjoy my life. That's a new experience. In fact, it connects very clearly with people of Baghdad, what they've been going through since 2003. And, of course, it was only a miniature example, but now we get some idea about life in occupied countries where the United States has chosen to go to war. And finally, I think, you know, there's an important development that's happened with the capture of the lone suspect and his admission or his explanation as to why he and his brother engaged in this activity. And they said very clearly, or he said very clearly from what we've heard, that he did it as a resistance to or as an objection to the United States war and occupation in Afghanistan and Iraq. And once that was put out in public, it's so interesting that silence on that issue has been overwhelming. Because he goes to what we call the why question, connecting U.S. foreign policy to these acts of terrorism. And that's not what we're encouraged to do. You know, take 9/11. We've been encouraged on the why question, oh, they're just jealous of our freedom. And then we leave it, we're supposed to leave it there, and we're supposed to go out and chant USA, USA, sing the Star Spangled Banner. But this young man gave us an opportunity, if we wanted to take it, to connect the acts of terrorism, anti-U.S., anti-Western terrorism, with U.S. foreign policy. It's something we're not encouraged to do. It's enough for our leadership, for us just to, to chant USA, USA, and leave it at that. But we have an opportunity here to do so, and unfortunately few of us have taken that opportunity.
Well, certainly not in the mainstream media. It's a predictable way of dealing with things, as terrorism is just something that's out there, and it's not anything that we do, or it's not anything that we're responsible in our actions overseas for.
Well, no, and I mean, we can understand that in terms of political leadership, using the issue of terrorism really to have us sort of dumb down and park our brains. You know, this is an awful act. It's the most dastardly deed someone could actually do. And in response, you know, we go to the emotional side of it, the grief, the sorrow. And then we're encouraged to go to the anger and the rage. And that ultimately leads in many cases to the revenge factor, revenge policy. And there's no reflection expected or encouraged in that transition. All it is we're innocent, they're guilty. As George Bush said, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. And that bipolar, contrived ideological context that we've been living with for quite some time, and particularly after 9/11. And it's unfortunate because, in fact, it's irresponsible, because as a liberal democratic society, citizens affect policy through public opinion. And if we're not making sober judgments, if we're just parking our brains and listening to whoever is shouting the loudest, you know, and chanting the loudest, USA, USA, then we're not really living up to our responsibilities as citizens or our rights as citizens.
Something that I would like to talk about just a little bit before we move on. And you were talking earlier about, you know, what is done, you know, what the FBI was doing, and all the way they were sifting through all this video and everything. And what is probably going to come out of this is much more cameras up everywhere in case something like this happens again, which means us giving up a little more freedom. And there's this idea that, you know, if we give up a little more freedom, we're going to be safe. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that is what we call the argument that there's a security fix to terrorism. And clearly there are some instruments of security which are useful. But on the other hand, the further we go down the security fix argument and the security fix path, we have to ask ourselves, well, what kind of society does that create in the end? You know, we as a liberal democratic society, we try to balance individual liberties and public safety. And hopefully, you know, we can maintain that balance. But our terrorist experts, our so-called terrorist experts, from the private and public sector say, no, there's a security fix, and the more security we have, the more instruments of security we have, the safer that we'll be. And all I say to them is, well, how's that working for us? That two young people can violate or can penetrate and do this kind of act in Boston or at our airports in 9/11. How is that working for us? And maybe we are orient ourselves to some other instruments in terms of fighting this terrorism, because we have lots of instruments. Because in the end, what we saw in Boston, the ultimate security fix is a lockdown society. We locked down a city. It was only temporary. But in the end, the logical extension of that is we have to have a lockdown society, which basically means we change the very nature of the kind of society that we have judged in the past and celebrated in the past as a fair and just and working society.
I remember hearing a interview with, an expert, I don't remember which one, who was saying, they were talking about how these guys slipped through and said, well, you're going to miss some once in a while. But if you look at the ones they've been catching, these are cases where, in most cases, it seems like there is an informant that approaches somebody and talks them into doing something, and then they catch them with weapons that the FBI has supplied them with. And it's like, yes, we're doing something, but it's more like, because they're not able to catch people like this, they're setting up people that, so they can have something to show that they're doing something.
You have to justify all the money that's being spent and all the new, what I call toys, that's being spent on law enforcement at the state, local, national level. You have to have a way to justify that. And so I would encourage people, if they're interested in the subject, Trevor Aronson has written a book called The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terror. And if they want to have a lot of evidence over 2001, case after case after case of sting operations by the FBI, and we have to ask, what is the purpose of this? Well, there's two purposes: to justify the spending on, quote, homeland security, national security issues and instruments, and also there's the fear factor, to keep a society, and this is the dangerous thing for our society, to keep a society in fear and therefore, depend on, quote, the experts, park your brain, depend on the experts, they know best. Well, that's a very dangerous, dangerous climate for people who treasure individual liberties.
Can you talk a little bit about who the FBI defines as terrorist?
Sure. The United States government, first of all, internationally, globally, there's no consensus on how to define terrorism. That's a product of what we call terrorism being a politically loaded concept. You go back to that sort of normal statement of the common statement of one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. And there's some reality to that. But the United States, for example, the United States government has several definitions of terrorism. They're about the same, whether we're talking about the CIA or the FBI or, the State Department, whatever. They all include the fact that they're non-state actors, so the states can't, nation states can't be involved in terrorism, particularly liberal democratic nation states. I won't go into that right now, but so let's take the FBI's definitions, because it's uncontroversial, really, and I don't have any problem with it. It basically says it's an act of violence or threat of violence against the civilian population to manipulate a government for social or political reasons. So what you've got in there is you've got the motive. So for it to be a terrorist act, you have to have some evidence that's a social or political motive. Now, that's their literal definition. They also add what's called an operational definition, which is that in order for it to be called a terrorist act, or someone to be called a terrorist, it must be a conspiracy. It must involve two or more people. And it's on that basis the FBI, for example, in the 90s, in terms of the violence against the family planning community or the violence against the black the epidemic of arson against the black churches, or the violence against the LGBT community, or the violence against the environmental movement, which most people don't really understand, because we hear it's eco-violence, which is violence by the environmental community, but it's just the opposite. But the point is, in all those cases, the FBI said, oh, well, we can't find a conspiracy of two people involved. We can't find, in terms of violence against the family planning community, we can't find it two people. So it can't be a conspiracy, therefore we're not going to call it terrorism. We're talking about series of bombings, series of murders, and other kinds of acts of violence. But at the same time, when it came to the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, one single individual, he was a terrorist, we were told, carrying out acts of terrorism. So they're contradicting their own definition, their operational definition, and the question is, well, why? Well, basically because historically and contemporarily it breaks down to, well, do we favor the violence that's going on? I mean, is it supporting the status quo, as in terms of the family planning violence or the, you know, the racist violence against the black churches, or are we against it as a challenge to the status quo, as in the case of the Unabomber, who, you know, he was criticizing industrial society. Well, we're an industrial society, so obviously he's on the out. You know, the FBI was so concerned about this single Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, because they violated their own principles, and they allowed the New York Times and the Washington Post to print and publicize his manifesto. That's how serious they took him. But again, in doing so, as a single individual, they violated their own operational definition. They've done that recently, by the way. They've done that with Christopher Dorner, the ex-cop, ex-SEAL here in Southern California, who had a personal vendetta, so there wasn't a political motive, a personal vendetta, and he was a single individual. And he was a terrorist. He was called a terrorist in public time and time again by the LAPD and the political officials. Same thing goes for the single terrorists in terms of the ag business. There are a number of states out there who say that the whistleblowers, who are often single individuals, who are documenting the awful conditions in which animals are placed in ag business, they have declared legislatively those acts of terrorism. Well, they're violating their own principle. So the point is, in the end, you know, what we have is a pattern of the consistent, inconsistent application of the concept of terrorism for political purposes.
And, you know, another example of that is that we all hear about eco-terrorists, but you never hear about anti-abortion terrorists.
No, because they can't find a conspiracy of two or more, so they allege.
Well, in some cases, the so-called eco-terrorist, it's one person that sets fire to an SUV, but it's something that's, you know, it's attacking property, and it's an act from the left. It seems to be much easier to excuse attacks from the right.
Well, this is an important point because, first of all, as David Helvarg documents in his book, War Against the Greens, the violence of the anti-environmental movement is much more pervasive and much more dangerous than any what they call eco-terrorist violence. But, of course, that goes back to, well, you know, as you just said, you know, is it anti-establishment violence or is it pro-establishment violence? Well, one is terrorism, which is the anti-establishment violence, the environmental movement, and happens to be, in many cases, from what's considered to be the left, but it's also the liberal movement. Interestingly enough, if we go back to Boston for a moment, we know that immediately the top suspect was a person of color who turned out to be a Saudi. He looked Middle Eastern. And after they decided he was innocent, but he was the first one cited of the people running away from the explosion. Well, according to the FBI's list of individuals and groups who are the most dangerous domestic terrorists, if we do racial profiling, which was done against him, all the white people who were running away from the explosions should have been the top suspects. Because if you look at the list of FBI's list of who are the major domestic terrorists, they are all primarily white people and white organizations, including the whitest of white, the Aryan Nation, the Minutemen, the Klan, etc. But of course, that doesn't fit the profile, the portrait of who the terrorists are that we have been encouraged to adopt.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, that is what is given to us by the media, and that's what most of us buy into.
Well, the media is simply following the directions and the information of the so-called terrorist experts, the ones who appear on TV and radio, etc. And, you know, this is the portrait that they draw. This is the portrait that they encourage. This is the analysis that they encourage, all the way from thinking there's a security fix to terrorism to who the terrorists are and who the terrorists aren't, you know, and what to do about it, et cetera, et cetera. So the media is reflecting the people they choose to have on their television and radio shows. I'm talking about the corporate media. To understand, you know, this phenomenon of terrorism.
Let's talk a little bit about the act of terrorism from governments and focus on things like drone bombings, attacks by drones. What is your take on that? Is that a form of terrorism?
Well, it is to me, and I've written about it. I mean, that is exactly what my last book, Strategic Terror, is about. It's tracking the history of what we call strategic bombing theory, which was adopted after World War I with the advent of the age of aviation and the fact that in World War I there was no what we call a decisive weapon that could win that war, and therefore all the, you know, the contending sides were dug into miles and miles of ditches and were in a very defensive posture, which they considered to be a feminized position of war. They want to be masculine, so you got to be on the offensive. So the airplane, the advent of the airplane post-World War I was considered to be this decisive weapon as it was developed by four thinkers, one of whom was Billy Mitchell, you know, sort of the godfather of the U.S. Air Force. And their argument was wars in the future will be fought from the air, and air power alone can win wars. And if, in fact, you follow the agenda of bombing, you know, strategic bombing of the civilian populations of the enemy's major cities, and kill a lot of people, and then you create a lot of refugees, and you go bomb the next city. And in the end, because you're bombing civilians, by which we mean women and children, the assumption by the theorists was that women and children don't have the same fortitude as the men to withstand the terror coming from the sky, and they will quickly force the government to capitulate. And, you know, and their argument was that, you know, it's a more efficient way of fighting wars. The war will quickly be over because women and children will be the primary victims, and secondly, it will be a less costly way of fighting wars because you don't have to have standing armies or navies, and that's costly. You just have to have a bomber fleet. And then they finally said it's, you know, less amoral way of fighting wars because, you know, again, you're saving what they call the warrior class, that were the most important people in society. And, you know, that's been the mantra in terms of how to fight and win future wars. It's now called shock and awe. What we saw in March of 2003, the bombing of the cities of Iraq, and particularly principally Baghdad, was nothing more than this strategic theory. Now, the original authors said, yeah, this is terrorism. You're absolutely right. We're unashamed that terrorism works, and it fights. You can fight and win wars using terrorism because you're targeting the civilian population, and that's how you win wars. Now, we've we know that terrorism has taken on some pejorative connotations since then, but again, the theory as it's evolved still is one in which you target civilian infrastructure, you make the civilian population suffer along with the military apparatus, and that's the way to fight and win, you know, modern warfare. So now we have drones, and of course now we're talking about the advantage not only of with drones, but even dropping bombs from 30,000 feet. It's called a robo-war. It's called clean war. Let's fight clean wars. You know, well, it's clean to the people in the air and to the people back in Nevada who are guiding, you know, the drones. But, of course, it's very dirty to people on the ground. But, again, who cares? Because they're the enemy, and either, you know, the militants, as they're called today, and then the militants sympathizes. If you're in the house with a militant, you must be a militant sympathizer. So, and if there's a little bit of collateral damage, well, okay, that's the price of war. That's what we call the fog of war. And so we can justify all that. So what their premise is, quite frankly, Wally, is that they're encouraging us to make a distinction between bombing to kill civilians and bombing knowing you'll kill civilians. What's called the intent argument. And that article on cluster munitions, I think, is, you know, important in lots of ways, but in particular because there's an attempted ban on cluster munitions. You know, these are the munitions that, when they explode in the air, they send out, you know, these little shrapnel over a cover of four football fields, and then 25% of them don't explode, so they lay on the ground as landmines until a kid or a farmer picks them up and loses a leg or loses their life. So the fundamental, either way, the fundamental victims are civilians. And so they are a weapon of state terror. And that's why, you know, 110 nations around the world have signed on to a ban of them. The problem is that the people who develop the weapons and use the weapons, those who I call the bombing nations, the Israels, the Russias, the United States, the French, the British to some extent, the Chinese, they haven't signed on to the ban because they know that it's a very useful instrument of terror to win wars and then also to remind the people when the bombs don't explode, when the explosives don't explode, to remind them of the power of their adversary in the peacetime, the post-war era.
Something else, when you're talking about civilians being killed by these drones, our government has a way of defining who's a civilian and who's a combatant. If you are of a certain age that you could be serving, in the military, sir, if you could be, then you're automatically defined as a combatant.
Well, I don't know. I must say I'm unfamiliar with that particular definition. What I do know is that they've gone the other way, and they have put in the category of non-combatant people in the armies or in the military who are not at war. In other words, if you're not, you know, if you're in an office somewhere in the Pentagon, right, or even if you're in the green zone and you're not, you know, in active combat, then you are considered to be a non-combatant, and therefore if the enemy attacks you, then that's an act of terrorism. Well, that's pretty convenient. So then you become part of the, quote, civilian population, although they have this category of non-combatant. But I understand what you're saying, even though I'm not familiar with any actually declaring that it makes sense that if you are of military age, and in particular if you are of male, then obviously you are eligible as a fighter, right? This is sort of what the original theorists of strategic bombing theory were getting at when they extended the battleground to the home front. But they extended the notion of combatant to everybody who's on the home front. So if you're working in a factory, right, or if you're a nurse tending to the wounded at the home front, that is to say back home, that's part of the battlefield, and that's why they wanted to target the civilian populations in major centers and thinking that that was a legitimate target of war.
Well, and let's talk about ethics, because we are seen as, you know, an ethical country, as, you know, the good guys. How do we ethically kill civilians?
Well, you do so very easily, but you you have a way to dodge the terrorism label. And, you know, there's many, many ways to do that, and I've discussed that in that book. I have a whole chapter on dodging the terrorism label, including, for example, I talked earlier about the fact that the thinking is that a liberal democratic state like ours cannot be part of the problem of terrorism. That if you're going to talk about state terrorism, you know, it's fascist states, it's authoritarian states of the right and the left, or Islamic states of the counter religion. In this day and age, it would be the Islamic states. And the way they do that is they simply make a distinction between force and violence and assume that, and rightly so, that terrorism is a form of violence, and so they argue, just briefly, that liberal democratic states, in terms of using the element of coercion, they're using force because it's legitimate. They have a set of conditions that must be fulfilled, and then on the other hand, non-liberal democratic states are using violence or illegitimate force. Coercion and therefore violence, and therefore they're part of the terrorism problem. And that's one way, it's a very effective way, I must say, of dodging the terrorism label. And so you don't have an ethical problem. You know, and another way is simply to, as I said earlier, to go to the intent argument. Well, if you're intending to kill civilians, you're unethical. If you know that civilians are going to be killed, but you're not directly targeting them, you know, you have a high ethical and moral standing to make. And but when you investigate these kinds of arguments, you know, they are left wanting. So what you're left with is simply a forced consensus or a forced position on what is ethical and what isn't ethical, and you're left with a situation of we're ethical and they aren't.
Bo, we have a couple of minutes left. You want to leave us with a closing thought?
Yeah, I think we have another chance here with you know, with the unfortunate events in Boston, to step back, hopefully, and you know, if you're out there chanting USSA and you're out there, you know, singing the Star Spangled Banner, okay, but. You know, as a citizen of a democratic society, we have a right and an obligation to think for ourselves. And the longer these kinds of things go on, it would seem that it would call for and people would want to do more than do the USA chant, that they would want to step back and do some sober judgments. The point is that you're going to have to do that on your own or with your friends, a collection of people, that's going to put you at odds with what we call the conventional wisdom. And because your leadership is not going to encourage you to do that. On the issue of terrorism, it's enough for them to say, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. This is a very black and white issue. It's good versus evil. Well, there's nothing in this world that is set up like that. So that hopefully the listeners will understand, increasingly understand, that that's a very contrived ideological climate for political purposes, that they're being manipulated by politicians who understand that terrorism creates an awful lot of emotions, and that hopefully they can step back, because there's an awful lot of evidence to the contrary. And if we're going to get back to being a country we can be proud of, being a country that other people will want to be proud of, then, you know, we've got to start that process.
Bo, thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Nice to talk to you, Wally.
We've been talking to Bo Grosskopf. He's a professor of international relations at California State University in Chico and California. And he's the author of several books, but Strategic Terror is the one we've been focusing on in this most recent one. All right, folks, stay tuned. Coming up next, we got Lillian Kerr with a bird's eye view.
On July 27th,
A Bird's Eye View, A Woman's Perspective with Lillian Kerr. This is a review of the book Mother Jones, The Most Dangerous Woman in America. The book was written by Elliot Gorn and it came out in 2001. This article appears on the website of womenshistory.about.com. Mother Jones was born May 1, 1830. Or was she? Elliot Gorn, author of the biography of Mother Jones, tells us that she was actually born on August 1, 1837, but moved her birthday to May 1 as a connection to the Haymarket May Day demonstration for the 8-hour day, and the year, probably, to add even more to the image of the white-haired Mother Jones. Gorn's most notable achievement in this biography may be his detailed research into and description of the early life of the woman who was born Mary Harris in Ireland. Sometimes he's uncovered new or forgotten facts, for example, her teaching certificate issued in 1857 in Toronto when she was 20. He also describes the horrors of the yellow fever epidemic in Memphis in 1867, when Mary Harris Jones lost her husband and all four of their children. Mary Harris Jones, Mother Jones, began writing her own biography in 1922 or 1923, when she was in her 80s, and after her most active participation in labor activism had ended. Errors in spelling in her autobiography are explained by the fact that she dictated the stories to Mary Field Parton, a reporter who's also a friend and mistress of Clarence Darrow. Darrow wrote the introduction to the first edition of Jones's autobiography, published in 1925. Elliot Gorn shows that many other inaccuracies are the result of Jones's memories of her own involvements as beginning earlier than Gorn can confirm from the historical record. Jones also shades the stories to favour her own partisan positions. Gorn brings vividly to life the times through which this young Mary Harris lived. Her short years of marriage to George Jones, member of the Iron Molders Union, her move to Chicago, and her many years as a dressmaker, her loss of shop, home and belongings to the Chicago fire, her growing interest in the labour movement, the impact of the Chicago Haymarket affair on her own life and on the Knights of Labour. The bulk of the biography by Elliot Gorn covers her active years in the labour movement and goes on to record the battles of the coal miners, the imprisonment of the grandmother Radical Jones, the children's crusade against child labour, her Socialist Party involvement, her minor involvement in the IWW, her opposition to John L. Lewis's leadership. These stories are told with historical detail, communicating effectively the energy, outrage, and commitment Jones continued to bring to her work. By the early 1920s, her failing health began to seriously slow her activism, at the same time that radical labor movement activism diminished in influence. She wrote her autobiography, attended fewer and fewer public events, and died on November 30, 1930. Gorn continues the story in his epilogue, documenting the ways the memory of the Mother Jones persona and person continued to evolve. In the 1930s, labor activists still honored her memory. A young Jean Autry even recorded The Death of Mother Jones, a song whose origin is obscure. But the labor movement of the 1940s and 1950s, with its distance from radical politics, all these contributed to the fading of her memory. Her autobiography went out of print, and copyright was even allowed to lapse. It was only in about 1970 that her memory began to be revived. The Charles Kerr Company published, at last, a second edition of the autobiography in 1972. Folk singers revived The Death of Mother Jones, and in 1976, a magazine promising a return to progressive-era journalistic muckraking named itself after her. Gorn's biography of Mother Jones itself can be seen as a maturing of this Mother Jones revival. At last, those interested in more than the image of Mother Jones can see her actual contributions to the labor movement in all their complexity. She becomes, in Gorn's book, not a sad or pathetic figure who often exaggerated her contributions and often sacrificed means for ends, but an even stronger, authentic human being, transforming adversity into commitment, mothering the whole of working-class America, and meeting challenges rare to the experience of white-haired women in their 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, then or now. Was Mother Jones a feminist? In the sense that she asserted a role for herself in a field dominated by men, yes. In the sense that she saw women's role as unique, nurturing, and supportive, and therefore ignored or opposed women's full political, social, and economic quality, perhaps not. She was concerned primarily with supporting the rights of male wage earners, but as a woman in a strong and non-traditional role who made a significant contribution to history, she is certainly an important figure in women's history. And that was a review of the book Mother Jones, The Most Dangerous Woman in America by Elliot Gorn. And this review appears at the website of womenshistory.about.com. And this has been Lillian Kerr with a bird's eye view.
This is the news in the Progressive Forum. I'm Larry Krizan. Food safety advocates are outraged over revelations U.S. Congress and President Obama approved an act that includes a provision purporting to strip federal courts of the ability to prevent the spread of genetically modified organisms. The provision is in the Consolidated and Further Continuing Appropriations Act of 2013, which would require the U.S. Department of Agriculture to issue temporary permits allowing the continued planting of GMOs by farmers, even when a court rules that the agency erred in its environmental impact review of the genetically modified organisms. The provisions, which critical people and activists call the Monsanto Protection Act, is one for which the multinational corporation Monsanto has been lobbying the U.S. Congress for at least a year. The legislation passed the U.S. House on March 6th of this year and the Senate on March 21st, with the President signing the legislation 5 days later, March 26th. Revelations of the provision, which was buried in the 587-page spending bill, have increased public awareness and interest in the issue of GMOs in the U.S. The provision states that if a determination of non-regulated status is or has been invalidated or vacated, the Secretary of Agriculture shall, notwithstanding any other provision of law, upon request by a farmer, grower, farm operator, or producer, immediately grant temporary permit or permits or temporary deregulation in part. U.S. Senator John Tester, a Democrat from Montana and one of the only family farmers in Congress, spoke out against the provision on the floor on the Senate. He said, the U.S. Congress is telling the Agricultural Department that even if a court tells you that you failed to follow the right process and tells you to start over, you must disregard the court's ruling and allow the crop to be planted anyway. Not only does this ignore the constitutional idea of separation of powers, but it also lets genetically modified crops take hold across this country, even when a judge finds it violates the law. Senator Tester described the issue as, once again, agribusiness, multinational corporations, putting farmers as serfs. Meanwhile, activists are holding Senator Barbara Mikulski, a Democrat from Maryland, partly responsible. She was the committee chair who allowed the amendment and could have addressed the provision in congressional hearings. Because the provision is temporary, it will likely come up for reauthorization in September of this year, an opportunity for public opposition to mount. Monsanto has proposals for numerous GMO crops in the pipeline that could be affected by this rider positively. Dave Murphy, who is founder of Food Democracy Now, commented, "I think the Monsanto Protection Act and how it was passed and how it was slipped into law is just another example of how this company operates, how they manipulate our democracy and they buy off our elected officials. This is another example of how they choose to operate within the rules of a democratic society. They're like the mafia. They go in and write the rules the way they want them to be." Senator Roy Blount, Republican from Missouri, inserted the provision into the spending bill, according to Politico. Monsanto just happens to be based in St. Louis, Missouri. In a historic vote on Monday, the European Union created continent-wide restrictions on the use of bee-harming pesticides. Despite pesticide industry influence there, a majority of countries voted to place a two-year restriction on three neonicotinoid products linked to a wide range of harms to honeybees. The chemicals included are clothianidin, imidacloprid, and thimethoxam. The EU vote comes after significant findings by the European Food Safety Agency indicating these pesticides pose unacceptable risks to bees and their use should be restricted. Along with habitat loss and pathogens, a growing body of science points to these neonicotinoid pesticides as a key factor in drastically declining bee populations. Paul Towers, a spokesperson for Pesticide Action Network North America, released the following statement. "European leaders followed the weight of the scientific evidence and moved swiftly to protect bees from the harms of neonicotinoid pesticides. U.S. officials, especially the Environmental Protection Agency, should be emboldened by European action rather than yielding to pressure from pesticide corporations. Unless you officials act soon, bee populations may not recover, threatening the livelihood of beekeepers and the agricultural economies that rely on pollination and honey production." In Europe, advocates continue to press for even greater restrictions on the use of neonicotinoid pesticides. These are largely used on sugar beets and canola. Keith Tyrell, Executive Director of Pesticide Action Network UK, released the following statement. "While we welcome the EU vote as a significant step forward, we are dismayed that it is only a temporary half measure, which goes nowhere near enough in protecting our bees and other vital pollinators from the harm of neonicotinoid pesticides." The Pesticide Action Network UK will continue to campaign for a complete moratorium on the use of neonicotinoid pesticides and for a thorough and independent review of the scientific research on the project. The Pesticide Action Network North America works to replace pesticide use with ecologically sound and socially just alternatives. As one of five autonomous PAN regional centers worldwide, they link local and international consumer, labor, health, environment, and agriculture groups into an international citizens action network. Federal authorities here are preparing legislation to remove endangered species protection for gray wolves in the lower 48 U.S. states. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service draft legislation, control of wolves will be transferred to state wildlife agencies. Responding to the news, scientists and conservation groups said that the rule reeks of politics, as ranching and agricultural industries have lobbied heavily for the delistment of the species from the act. Jamie Rappaport-Clark, who is president of Defenders of Wildlife, commented, "This is politics versus professional wildlife management. The service is saying, we're done, game over, whatever happens to wolves in the U.S. is a state thing. They're declaring victory long before science would tell them to do so." The law carves out an exception for a small population of Mexican wolves in the Southwest, which as a distinct subspecies of the gray wolf would continue to receive federal protections. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said last Friday the rule was under review and would be published in the Federal Register and open to public comment before a final decision is made. And Californians gained a key victory in their fight to protect their state's water and air on Monday when three bills that halt the practice of fracking won votes in the California State Assembly Natural Resources Committee. The three bills call for a moratorium on the controversial and polluting extraction method, allowing the state more time to examine the threats posed on California's environment and public health. California State Assemblyman Richard Bloom, author of Assembly Bill 1301, said, "The lack of regulations is in an environment that should be regulated is a recurrent theme. Public and scientific concerns have increased exponentially, yet regulatory oversight lags behind." The bill was sponsored by the Center for Biological Diversity, Food and Water Watch, and Clean Water Action. That California bill, along with another Assembly Bill 649 and 1323, will next go to the Assembly Appropriations Committee. Andrew Grinberg of Clean Water Action called the vote an important step in the effort to protect California from the dangers of fracking. This committee gets it that the state needs to slow down and assess the many threats to our air, water, climate, and communities of extreme oil extraction. Pacific Director for Food and Water Watch, Kristen Lynch, said, "From the food that California farmers grow today to the long-term future of our state's water resources and air, California's economy and vital resources hang in the balance if we allow fracking to continue in California." And in our final story, it was 10 years ago, on May 1st, 2003, that then-President George W. Bush stood with a banner draped behind him saying, "Mission accomplished." Bush's now notorious premature speech declared American operations had ended in Iraq. Bush in 2003 delivered the televised address off the coast of San Diego from the USS Abraham Lincoln. Yet Iraq today is one of the world's most neglected crises, where statistics of daily violence, death, and insecurity, and the people behind those statistics, belie a war that is supposedly over, according to a report released on yesterday's 10-year marker. The report, titled "Mission Unaccomplished," comes from the UK-based War Child. This is a charity working for children in war-torn countries. Their report warns that Iraqi children are being abandoned by the international community as a general and inevitable risk of total collapse of the state remains a possibility. Among the statistics the report cites, between December 3, 2012 and April 23rd of this year, over 1,200 Iraqi civilians have been killed, averaging 9 deaths per day. The report notes this figure is likely a low estimate. An estimated 692 children and young people have been killed since December of last year. Nearly 1 million Iraqi children are affected by the presence of landmines, which limit their access to essential services, and hundreds of children have been maimed or killed by exploded cluster bomblets since the year 1991. There are an estimated 35,000 Iraqi infant deaths every year. One in four Iraqi children has stunted physical and intellectual development due to undernutrition. In 2010, 7 years after the conflict began, it was estimated that over a quarter of Iraqi children, or 3 million of them, suffered from varying degrees of post-traumatic stress disorder. The life expectancy of an ordinary Iraqi has gone down by 2 years in just over a decade. The group War Child's Iraq Country Director stated, "The international community cannot afford to ignore Iraq, and there is an urgent need to exercise harder diplomatic and economic pressure on the Iraqi government to save lives and to protect its citizens." And in the end, ex-President Bush is lauded at his $250 million library, which opened to the public on that same 10-year anniversary of the Holocaust Operation Iraqi Freedom. And that's been some of the news on the Progressive Forum.
On July 27, 2005, KPFT was granted a license by the Federal Communications Commission to serve the public interest as a public trustee until August 1, 2013. Our license will expire August 1, 2013. We have filed an application for license renewal with the FCC. A copy of this application is available for public inspection during our regular business hours. It contains information concerning this station's performance during the last 8 years. Individuals who wish to advise the FCC of facts relating to our renewal application and to whether the station has operated in the public interest should file comments and petitions with the Commission by July 1st, 2013. Further information concerning the Commission's broadcast license renewal process is available at 419 Lovett Boulevard, Houston, Texas, 77006, or may be obtained from the FCC, Washington, D.C., 20554. KPFT, Houston.
Hey, Answer Coalition, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, organizes against war while fighting for social and economic justice at home, including the struggle against racism and all forms of discrimination and bigotry. For more details, you can check out answercoalition.org. The Answer Coalition is active in the fight against war abroad and war at home. Cuts to schools, housing, social services, financial aid, and other needs of people often become money for drones, tanks, and military intervention. Answer is active in the fight for justice everywhere. Want to learn more? You can simply learn by visiting answercoalition.org.
This is KPFT. This is KPFT, 90.1 Pacifica Radio. And we're going to have Lillian coming up next, but quick, of course, we're going to do a real quick announcement. We just had somebody walk in with two pairs of tickets. Jewel is going to be performing at the Arena Theater tonight. If you want to come by here real quick and pick those up, you can get them. We've got two pair. Why don't you go ahead and give us a call. Let us know you're coming by. 713-526-5738. Now to Lillian Kerr.
Good evening, this is Lillian Kerr on the Progressive Forum. Many of us are familiar with Paul Roverson, the riveting African-American singer and actor who is known not only for his beautifully resonant singing voice, but who became politically involved as a response to the Spanish Civil War, fascism and social injustices. His advocacy of anti-imperialism, affiliation with communism, and his criticism of the US government caused him to be blacklisted during McCarthyism. Ill health forced him into retirement from his career, but to the end he remained unapologetic for the unpopular political stances that he took. However, I don't think any of us know about his amazing wife, Islanda Cardozo Good Roberson, who was equally as passionate and political as her husband. To talk to us about this woman's brilliant life, a life of courage and fierce principles, is the author of the first, as far as I know, biography of Islanda Roberson, Barbara Ransme, professor of African American Studies, Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Barbara Ransme, welcome to the Progressive Forum.
Thanks for having me, Lillian.
I fell in love with the subject of your book, Islanda.
which
you describe as the large and unconventional life of Mrs. Paul Roberson. And this woman was amazing, to say the least. First of all, I was captivated by the map of her travels that you display. And the fact that she traveled all the continents, as far as I can tell. Amazing, except for South America.
At a time when most black women lived very circumscribed lives, you know, she was on five continents and over 50 countries.
And not only that, but when travel was by ship.
Yeah.
I mean,
she traveled by ship, she traveled by plane, she traveled by car. She made use of various modes of transportation,
right.
But it was really when air travel was in its infancy, so
right.
It was difficult and somewhat dangerous as she moved about the country, and then she traveled inside Africa,
exactly.
Through the Congo and Uganda and South Africa, you know, by train and plane as well as car.
Right. Well, we jumped right into the middle there, but so, so she's born in Chicago, I believe.
No, she's born in Washington, D.C.
Oh, Washington, D.C.,
yeah.
That's right.
She was born in Washington, D.C. in 1895.
And the father of the family passes away.
Mm-hmm. And the mother moved to New York and then to Chicago, and then back to New York.
Right. Now, they were fairly, I mean, you could describe them as middle class. Is that correct, Barbara?
Well, they were middle class, and they were middle class until her father died, and then her mother really grappled with, you know, sort of a brief experience of poverty and economic challenges as she was a widow trying to support three children. So as Landa, you know, kind of lived on this cusp of privilege and, you know, and despair in a sense. But for the most part, her family was educated.
Right.
They had some resources. So that was her overall experience.
She did go to college.
Yeah, I mean, she went to, she was very much the intellectual, which I think is an important thing. I mean, sometimes you talk about women and particularly the wives of famous men, and, you know, they were stalwarts, they were supporters, but, you know, we don't talk about them as fighters, as independent, as intellectuals in their own right. And as Landa Robeson was all those things. She got a chemistry degree at Columbia University and worked as a chemist, and then she changed careers.
And again, this is early in the 20th century, 1910s,
1910s. Yeah, in the 19-teens. Well, she was at Columbia in the 19-teens, and she got her degree in early 1920s. But then she went and studied at the London School of Economics when she and Paul Robeson were living there with Branislaw Malinowski, who was a famous and problematic anthropologist.
Yeah.
And later she pursued her studies for a Ph.D. She never got the Ph.D. in anthropology. But she did, you know, draft a thesis and took her exams and so forth. So she got formal training, but she got a lot of informal intellectual training as well.
Well,
of course, she authored or co-authored three books.
Right.
So.
I mean, you could tell she was just had such a lively intellect. I mean, she was curious, she was questioning, she was so very engaged.
Right. And, you know, as a result of her marriage to Paul Robeson, you know, at least initially the reason for her travels was that he was traveling all over the world, and so she traveled with him, and she took her curiosities with her, and she, you know, she interviewed people. She interviewed Mahatma Gandhi, for example, in 1931. She had hoped that would be published. It was never published, but it was a real pivotal point in her own political maturation. You know, and she interviewed many black French expatriates from various French colonies who were living in Paris in the 1930s. You know, so she spent a lot of time doing her ethnography as an anthropologist, you know, really trying to absorb this very large and complex world that she was living. I mean, she really, I say in the book, you know, she was kind of on the precipice of history at a number of points. Because
she was in that Harlem Renaissance period in the 30s, and there were so many fascinating intersections with people that we're all familiar with that their paths crossed with Islanda.
Right. You know, well, the Harlem Renaissance, yes. Before they left, actually. They left Harlem in 1928 to 1939.
Okay.
But the Harlem Renaissance, you know, in that earlier period, you know, Langston Hughes or Neil Hurston, many of those famous names. But when I'm thinking about the moments, the historical moments that she was witness to, she traveled with Paul to the front lines of the Spanish Civil War in 1938. She was there at the founding of the United Nations in 1945. She visits China in 1949, 2 months after Mao's revolution. And at that time meets Madame Sun Yat-sen, Sun Qingling. So, you know, just these really extraordinary 20th century events that she was very, very close to and wrote about and experienced and incorporated into her worldview.
And she,
very large life.
Yes. She and Paul were quite fascinated with Russia during post-Bolshevik revolution.
They were. They were interested in the Soviet Union. They were interested in communism.
Right. As an ideal, it was a place where there wasn't this racial prejudice that they were experiencing here in the United States.
Right, that was one thing. But also, I think it was a time, you know, in the 1930s when, of course, the Great Depression in this country really made a lot of people question, you know, the logic and the humanity of capitalism. And so they looked to what they saw as a socialist experiment in the East. And Paul Robeson actually often said that it was through the African students that they met in London in the late 20s and early 30s that he first became curious about the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union was, of course, supporting certain African independence struggles, and that was his, that initially piqued his interest and curiosity. So they did. They visited the Soviet Union a number of times. Actually, Aslanda's two brothers migrated there. One of them lived there his entire life, the other one only for a short while. And they put their son in school there for nearly 2 years. So so they did have close ties to the Soviet Union, and that was, you know, one part of their internationalism.
Right.
Wasn't the entire part of the story, though. I think Africa is another big part of that story.
So they do meet, she meets a Prince Tahomey, or what was...
She meets
she's,
Prince,
she gets involved...
Kojo Tuvalu Ho-Inu is his last name. He's a Dahomeyan prince.
And Dahomey is now Benin.
It is.
Right.
So he, she meets him actually in Harlem in the 20s.
Okay.
But he's the person who really entices her to want to know more about sub-Saharan Africa. He's her confidant and escort around Paris in 1932 when she and Paul were having difficulties in their marriage, and she visited Paris for that summer. But he introduces her to a whole group of black Parisians who were from Martinique and French Guyana and Dahomey and other parts of the African diaspora. And that's really when she began to make a commitment to the cause of African independence, and decided that this was going to be a part of her life's work.
Yeah, it was really interesting. In Paris, she moves in this circle. There are all these Africans that had left, as you said, the diaspora. But, I mean, we have to remember that all of Africa was pretty much under colonial power of various countries at this time. And I guess it was just beginning to bubble up, the talk of anti-colonialism and perhaps getting some sort of independence.
Yeah, well, in terms of real organization, but of course, you know, from the beginning of colonialism, there probably was talk of defeating it.
It
just wasn't the means to do so. But when she travels to South Africa and Uganda in 1936, and think of this as a black woman traveling to colonial Africa in 1936. It was a complicated and difficult journey. She meets people in South Africa who are part of the African National Congress and the early black freedom movement in South Africa. She goes to a famous conference in Bloemfontein in 1936, and she meets people like Z.K. Matthews and A.B. Zuma, who become legendary figures in the African National Congress.
Right.
So she's seeing at those early, you know, in the 1930s, you know, it's a couple of decades before independence will be achieved, but she sees the early rumblings of freedom movement in Africa, and she allies herself with it.
And she becomes friends. I like Daryl and Mildred Randall. These are her friends in Johannesburg.
Right.
And they give her some, they give her insight in what's going on in South Africa.
Right. Yeah. They were a part of a kind of a missionary movement, but missionaries who were like a lot of Catholic folks who ended up in Central America and then had to, you know, make decisions about their politics that sometimes differed from the church. So so she had friends throughout sub-Saharan Africa because of her travels who, once, you know, she returned to London, which is where she was living at the time, you know, continued to write to her these very, very long and detailed letters. And, of course, you know, this is before the Internet, and this is before certain kinds of rapid communication. So people were sending long letters telling people what was happening on the ground, what kind of resistance was going on, what kind of repression was going on. And she really valued that line of communication that she had through her networks of friends and colleagues.
So she was traveling to Africa to for her own knowledge, to gain to understand what people were going through in these various countries?
Yeah, well, when she goes in 1936, she had already been studying at the London School of Economics. And by the way, when she's studying at the London School of Economics, one of her classmates there is Jomo Kenyatta.
Oh, wow.
Who, of course, becomes, you know...
She has met every influential figure.
I know. Well, it's like a who's who.
Yes.
I mean, I was a bit starstruck just reading her her diary, because, you know, from literary figures to political figures.
Well,
you know,
I have to say, Barbara, I was intrigued that she had a liaison with Noel Coward.
Right. And we don't know quite what to make of that because, of course,
But they were very close friends.
They were very close friends.
So she much so that Paul got worried.
Romantic relationship. Now, later, of course, you know, he was gay.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we don't know the extent of that relationship, but it was a very intimate friendship.
Right.
She also had a very close friendship with Jawaharlal Nehru of India, the first Prime Minister of India,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
who exchanged letters with her, called her, you know, my dearest Essie, and they confided in one another and maintained really for many years a close correspondence, as did Nehru's sister, Vijayalakshmi Pandit,
really?
Who became the first woman secretary of the UN General Assembly, and she was a close friend of Eslanda. So really some of the key personalities of the 20th century world, literary and political, particularly left-wing political,
mm-hmm.
you know, were a part of her circle.
So out of this, she publishes one of her books, Africa Travels.
Africa Journey,
Africa Journey, 1945.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which sounds like a very comprehensive discussion, or I guess a collection of essays.
Well, it really was a revised version of her travel diary mm-hmm. from 1936, and she presents it as an ethnography,
mm-hmm.
Because she does in-depth ethnographic interviews with the Toro people that she spent time with in a village called Kabarole in Uganda
mm-hmm.
that year, that is 1936. But the book doesn't get published until 1945. It's called African Journey. So she really goes kind of day by day and talking about her experiences, which
like
is just absolutely fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating also her observations because she's rejecting some of the racist depictions of Africa at the time of being backward and primitive and all of this and quite forward looking in her appreciation of, you know, the rich culture, the sophisticated intellects, the complex politics of, you know, her, you know, African colleagues and brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm. And this I was very fascinated by this book that she and Pearl Buck wrote together.
Right, right.
American
Argument.
Exactly.
And it's aptly named because
yeah.
they argue throughout the book with each other.
But it's such a great thing that they decided to do this.
Yes, yes. Well,
so talk about
Eslanda, who was just called Essie, so
right.
I figure after a 7-year relationship as her biographer, I can call her Essie
mm-hmm.
too. So Essie admired Pearl Buck and Pearl Buck's writings about China,
mm-hmm.
And they were introduced, and then they, you know, concocted this idea of doing a book together, and what it evolved into is really a series of reciprocal interviews between
mm-hmm.
the two of them, talking about a whole range of subjects, many of which they disagreed about,
right.
but respectfully.
Right, but each, yeah, wow, is there anything like that now? I couldn't think of anything. Very interesting.
Well, you know, different medium now. I mean,
yeah,
you know, you can
yeah.
think of online or on YouTube people having, you know, interviews with one another about shared ideas. And
right.
I guess maybe that
yeah.
Stands in place of a written text that would do that.
But you could tell each woman respected the other, even
mm-hmm.
though they did have strong opinions and in some, as you say, opposing opinions on some issues.
Right.
One of them was communism, as we talk about.
Right.
The other thing that I was struck by was this gathering that was held by Lillian Smith in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that
yeah.
was really neat. And she does this in Georgia, which is deeply segregated, you know, and apparently this gathering, and Lillian Smith was a Southern writer, and I'm not too familiar with her, but she decides to do this and almost in defiance of the current segregationist laws in her state.
Right, right. And, you know, some friendships came out of that
yeah.
gathering, but, yeah, it was a violation of segregation laws to hold a gathering like this, and it was a weekend gathering of some very prominent, outspoken women, black women and white women from the North and the South, and
right.
Eslanda Robeson was one of them, and they spent, you know, a lot of time, many hours, eating, drinking, arguing, getting to know each other. And I think, you know, Lillian Smith may have had a kind of romantic view of what would come out of this kind of interracial sisterhood. But it was, yeah, I mean, it was an interesting moment. It was one of the times that Eslanda was spending a little bit more time in the South, which, you know, she had not done extensively. But, yeah, I mean, one of the interesting snapshots in her, you know, interesting life.
Very, very rich life. So they travel a lot. They have her and Paul have a son together, Paul Jr.
Right.
But they do go through, as you touched on earlier in our conversation, Barbara, you did, you know, they do have, they go through a rocky period. Paul, is an intriguing man to many women.
Diplomatically put.
Yeah. And this caused her a lot of distress.
Yeah, well, they, you know, I think they eventually settled into an open marriage, a partnership that endured for 44
right.
years.
But they did love each other. I mean, he clearly loves her and respects her.
I think that was indeed the case. But, you know, it really evolved from a very passionate romance to something that was a little bit different than that. I mean, it was a marriage, but he had other relationships. I didn't have evidence that she actually consummated other relationships, but there was the hint of that. He was much more explicit about it. And she knew about many of his partners. Some of them were her friends. And, you know, it was complicated. I mean, they traveled in art circles where there were a number of open relationships. And I always remind people, too, Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis, who are a well-known couple, African-American couple in the theater and made a number of films together. Ozzie Davis died a few years ago. But they are often viewed as this glowing example of kind of, you know, committed heterosexual black couple in the arts that whose relationship endured. But they had an open marriage for quite a number of years, and they were also friends of the Robesons. So, you know, people led complicated lives, but the thing that stood out for me with them is that there seemed to be mutual respect and dependence on one another for certain things. And it endured for 44 years, which is a pretty long time.
Yeah. So let's go back to they're actually, right after World War II, they become the targets of the FBI. Because of their political activities, I guess their frequent visits to Russia during... Talk about that a little bit.
Well, they're targets of the FBI. They're targets of British intelligence. So they are very open about their support for the Soviet Union. They travel there. They talk, as you indicated, about not experiencing racism during their travels there and feeling a certain kind of freedom that they didn't feel in the United States. And they also talk about the socialist experiment that was going on there. So they're pretty open about that. And of course, you know, after World War II, the U.S. and Soviet Union having had a brief alliance during the war, but after the war, the Cold War sets in, and there's a real persecution of people in this country who had any kind of communist sympathy. So a number of their friends went to jail and were persecuted, and the Robesons themselves were under surveillance and were persecuted. They had their passports taken.
Yeah,
their passports were taken for 8 years, and Paul Robeson was blacklisted and had difficulty earning a living. They had a home. They lost their house. And in 1953, Eslanda was summoned before Joe McCarthy, who was the real crusader during the early period of the Cold War.
Right.
He was a U.S. senator. And she was summoned, and the pretext under which she was summoned to testify about her alleged subversive activities was the book that she published, African Journey.
Wow.
That book appeared on the bookshelves in State Department libraries in other parts of the world, and that was cause for her to be summoned before McCarthy Senate Committee. And she was questioned about her loyalty because of her, you know, adamant advocacy against colonialism. So that was quite interesting. But she was very defiant.
She was.
She refused to name names, and she kind of flipped the script and accused McCarthy's committee of racism. You know, she said, "I don't recognize this committee because Many of its members come from southern states where black people can't vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so she...
Very good.
And many of her friends who were watching the testimony were nervous that she was going to either be held in contempt or thrown in jail, but she managed to say her piece and not have that happen.
Wow. And this must have been, as you say, a hardship because Paul had to travel for his singing and his singing career, and he couldn't do that anymore.
That's right. That's right.
So I guess this comes to she passes away in New York?
Yeah, in 1965. Mm-hmm. She had 3 bouts with cancer, and in 1965, really a few days before her 70th birthday, mm-hmm. She dies.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was an amazing woman. And I'm
she was. It was an interesting
How did you discover her, Barbara?
Well, like most people, I knew about Paul,
right.
But I didn't know much about Essie. When I was an undergraduate student many, many years ago, I came across her in the archives at the Schomburg Library in Harlem,
mm-hmm.
and I wrote a little short article about her at that time, and I always had her in the back of my mind, and I thought someone else would have written about her. And then when I was looking for a book project, about 7 years ago, I looked into it again. No one had written it, and I decided to take up the task. So,
well, thank goodness.
I'm glad I did. And, you know, I just want to say, too, you know, I'm a historian. I'm mm-hmm. also an activist, and I always think of these projects and think of what are the lessons. And for Eslanda Robeson's story, I think, you know, the dangers of repression, mm-hmm. of political censorship and repression is one of the lessons. The importance of international solidarity, because she was an African-American woman, but she didn't have a parochial bone in her body.
Yep.
I mean, she spoke out against injustices all over the world,
mm-hmm.
Places that she had no personal connection to.
Right.
I think that's an important lesson. And the importance of recovering women's stories.
Mm-hmm.
Women in progressive and radical movements, but women in American history and world history in general.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, for women to step forward into these arenas is different. It takes a different kind of courage, and I think it's wonderful we give their stories this kind of the publicity they deserve.
Yep.
I really do.
I agree.
Well, thank you so much. I've been talking to Barbara Ransby, who has written the first biography of Eslanda, the large and unconventional life of Mrs. Paul Robeson, who I've fallen in love with. And don't you wish you could have met her?
I do. But, you know, it's funny the relationship that a biographer has with her
right.
subject. I mean, she has passed away many years ago, but I do feel like I know her in a very... in a very intimate way, that spending hours and hours and hours reading her words and following
right.
her path, that's where it leads you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us here tonight, Barbara Ransby.
Thank you very much, Lillian.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Once again, for our listeners, the book is called Eslanda. It was written by Barbara Ransby, and it is available right now at any bookstore. And this is Lillian Kerr on the Progressive Forum.
This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 Pacifica Radio. Coming up next, we're going to have an interview with Juan Gonzalez, co-host with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, but also he's co-director of the new film, Harvest of Empire, The Untold Story of Latinos in America. And we're going to start off with the trailer for that film.
We are all Once again, the streets of our country were taken over today by people who don't belong here.
Well, when the immigrants come, they come with a culture of criminality. It's out of control.
They put a strain on our Social Security, our education, our health care.
They never teach us in school that the huge Latino presence here is a direct result of our own government's actions in Mexico, the Caribbean, and Central America over many decades. Thousands upon thousands of Puerto Ricans were actually recruited to come work here in the United States.
The feeling was we could very easily overthrow this progressive government and make it a lot easier for the United Fruit Company and other American businesses to operate in Central America.
From the very beginning, the West depended for its labor on Mexicans.
Are you a communist, Fidel? Wait for the history. The history will say what we are.
I had never seen anything like El Salvador. I was more frightened there than Vietnam. What was going on there was the slaughter of the innocents.
When you finance and train a gang of uniformed butchers and they begin wholesale killing, the people don't emigrate. They flee.
The instability that we have contributed to creates the kind of chaos and disarray that leads to more immigration.
I believe in the idea of amnesty for those who have put down roots even though they may have entered illegally.
The reality is that America is changing. By the end of this century, a majority of the people will trace their origins not to Europe, but to Latin America.
We're all humans. We all have the same abilities. We all have the same potential.
America has always been a nation in the process of becoming, in process of change. It is an immigrant nation.
This is KPFT, 90.1 Pacifica Radio in Houston. The program's a progressive forum, and that was a trailer for the new film, Harvest of Empire, The Untold Story of Latinos in America. And it's co-directed by Juan Gonzalez. And a lot of you are familiar with him because he's co-producer with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now. Juan, welcome to the progressive forum.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. And just one correction. I narrate the film, but I'm not the co-producer. The co-producers are Wendy Thompson Marquez and Eduardo Lopez.
My mistake. Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. And you want to start off, this came out of a book that you wrote some years ago. What were your reasons for writing the book?
Well, I wrote Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America. Actually, it was published in 2000, and I started work on it in the early 1990s, basically out of a dissatisfaction with the kinds of histories and accounts of the Latino experience in the country that had been written up until that time, because I felt that for the most part, while some were really good in terms of talking about the Mexican-American community or the Puerto Rican or the separate nationalities, there was very little that tried to tie together the various Latino ethnic groups, how they came to the country and what propelled them to come here. And most importantly, though, there was no tie-in in any of the books I'd seen in terms of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America and how that had affected the massive migrations of Latinos to the United States after World War II. So basically, I tried to sort of tie together what's been going on in Latin America as well as the Latino presence in the country. You can't understand one without the other. You can't understand the huge migration here without understanding the role that the American Empire has played in the construction of the American Empire, especially in Latin America.
Well, let's start there. Can you start telling us about what some of the policies were that our government had that started this migration?
Well, I think the key, obviously, is initially the conquest of Latin American lands. The biggest, of course, being the Mexican-American War and the seizure of about half the territory of Mexico, now called the Southwest United States, and the need throughout the late 19th century for labor to work the West and so much of the labor in the West in the late 19th century and early 20th century was of Mexicans imported by American industry to provide the manpower for the railroads, the copper mines of Arizona, the sheep herding industry of New Mexico, the gold mines and silver mines of Nevada and Colorado. And so much of the wealth of the country in that early period after the Mexican-American War was so much dependent on Mexican labor in the West. And, of course, later with the Spanish-American War and the acquisition of Puerto Rico as a colony, which became really the most valuable colony in U.S. history in terms of the wealth it produced for American companies here, that it then started translating into the importation of Puerto Rican labor to come to the United States to work in agriculture and work in the industries of the Midwest and the Northeast. So I document in the book this huge pull factor in terms of the needs of American businesses bringing contracting laborers from Mexico and Puerto Rico to come. And then, of course, later on with the Dominican and the Cuban influxes, again, a result of U.S. policies that led first to the Cuban Revolution and the massive migrations of Cubans here, and then to the huge influx of Dominicans after the U.S. invasion of the Dominican Republic in 1965. And subsequent years, as many people fled the dislocation created by that invasion, you started having the large numbers of Dominicans come into the country. And then, of course, climaxing in the 1980s, with the huge Central American migrations, which were a direct result of the conflicts and the terror created by repressive regimes in Central America, from in Salvador and Guatemala, that forced so many people to flee their countries as a result of governments essentially bankrolled and installed by the United States.
Well, and you had a genocide going on in Guatemala. The Mayan people were being attacked by their government. And you want to talk about that?
Well, yes. In the book, but especially in the film goes into depth into what happened in Guatemala from early on the 1950s with the CIA-backed coup against the Arbenz government through the large repression, the guerrilla resistance against the coup leaders, and then the huge genocide, as you mentioned, that occurred against the Mayans. And we have, for the first time in the film, footage that's never been seen in the United States of some of the atrocities committed in Guatemala. And there's a very powerful interview with Rigoberta Menchú, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, and who recounts the murder of her own father and other Guatemalan activists when the Guatemalan government burned the Spanish embassy and killed scores of people who were burned alive inside the embassy. And there's actual original footage in the film of that incident from Guatemalan television. It's never been seen in the United States. There's a lot of archival footage for the first time is available in this country, in addition to sort of old historical footage of some of the best stuff that the commercial networks did in the 70s and 80s about the wars in Central America.
You touched on El Salvador. I mean, the death squads there were just horrendous. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, well, excellent footage and a narrative of what happened in El Salvador. Father Roy Bourgeois is interviewed in the film, as are a couple of Maryknoll nuns who served for many years in Central America, as well as the former U.S. ambassador to El Salvador and Ambassador White, and they talk about the role of our government, of the death squads, and of the efforts of ordinary Salvadorans to try to throw off tyranny. There's a fantastic interview with a survivor of the torture of the death squads in El Salvador, who later fled to the United States as a refugee and she details what happened to her in her country. So again, it's a very, very powerful film that they've managed to put together. When the filmmakers came to me 7 or 8 years ago saying they wanted to turn my book into a movie, I was kind of skeptical. I didn't think that they were going to be able to pull it off. It was too unwieldy a subject matter. And of course, the people that they interview or deal with in the film are not the same as the ones who I dealt with in the book. But they basically kept to the same general theme. The harvest of the empire, the Latino presence in the United States is an unintended consequence of the growth of the American empire in Latin America.
Well, and you had people fleeing from these conflicts and coming here. Our country is backing this violence in these countries, and the people are fleeing and coming here. But besides that, though, you have what happened in Mexico with NAFTA. And can you talk about how that affected people, farmers who were able to work off the land and other people there whose lives were directly affected by NAFTA?
Well, that's also part of, again, it's not just the political and the military impact of the United States and Latin America, but it is also the economic impact. And so, yes, the film does detail what happened in Mexico subsequent to NAFTA and the essentially dumping of American agricultural products, wheat and corn, into Mexico at much cheaper prices that, in essence, destroyed the domestic corn production of Mexico, the key staple crop of Mexico, so that more and more corn is now imported by Mexicans from the United States. And as a result, estimates are that more than 2 million Mexican small farmers were basically forced off the land subsequent to NAFTA, and then joined the ranks of the unemployed in the cities and along the northern territories of Mexico, and of course became those who then began to migrate in huge numbers at the turn of this new century and for the last decade.
Is there something else you would like to say about the way people were, by the U.S. policies, were driven from Latin America to come to the U.S. before we move on to something else?
No, I think that those are some of the key aspects. In every country, there's been, once you study the actual history of what happened in the country, you really understand why there's been such a huge migration. And, of course, the film comes at a timely moment, because right now in Congress, the debate has begun over comprehensive immigration reform. The debate that will continue for many months into the fall, as both the Senate and the House begin to consider their own versions of immigration reform, and then there has to be a reconciliation of the two bills. Assuming that both houses do pass a bill, they'll undoubtedly be very different, so there'll have to be an attempt by both houses to create a third merged bill. So this is going to be a long process. And unfortunately, the way that the debate is now going in the media, it's basically a soundbite debate over, quote, illegals or border security, or pay your fines and pay your back taxes or get to the back of the line, but no real discussion of what has propelled this huge migration, largely from Latin America. I mean, two-thirds of all the undocumented immigrants in the United States come from one country, Mexico. So it's essentially, I've always thought it's the crux of the undocumented problem in the United States. It's a bilateral problem between Mexico and the United States. If you can solve that, you solve a huge portion of it. And so much more are from Central America. So that I think the Americans get a better handle on what fueled the migration, they'll be able to also get a better sense of the human beings involved and their own individual stories, which both my book and the film try to present. I think they'll have a more compassionate and a more comprehensive understanding of why immigration policy and the current regulations have to be dramatically changed.
Well, and there's something about the mainstream media where they don't look at, you know, what the cause is. It's just all about, it's like you woke up one day and you have all these people here. It's like, we don't want to take any responsibility. Our government doesn't want to take any responsibility for their policies.
Yes, I think that's true. And you know, I think one of the most powerful sections in the film is a wonderful interview with Juno Diaz, the Pulitzer Prize winning and, you know, probably one of the best known authors in the United States.
You want to talk about some of the other people? You have some really notable people in this film. Juan, are you there? All right, we seem to be having some technical problems. Juan? Okay, we seem to have lost Juan. We're going to go to some music while we get him back on the phone. We're talking to Juan Gonzalez, co-host with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! And he is the narrator of a brand new film. It's based on his book. And we're going to be talking, it's Harvest of Empire. And it's going to be coming to Houston. It's going to be at Sundance Theater, and it opens tomorrow night. So stick around, and we'll be right back with Juan Gonzalez. This is KPFT in Houston, and we've got Juan back on the phone. Juan Gonzalez, narrator for the new film, Harvest of Empire, which is going to be opening here in Houston coming up tomorrow night, and it's going to be at the Sundance Cinemas. Juan, glad we could get you back.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. We got cut off, but yes, it's going to be at the Sundance Cinema for a week. I should be playing about four times a day for the next week, and but the openings will be tomorrow. Yes, I think the as we were talking about some of the individuals who were interviewed, but
yes,
it's got not only fantastic archival footage and graphics, but it's got this incredibly lineup of folks from Rigoberto Menchú, as I mentioned before, Juno Diaz, the Geraldo Rivera, the former ABC and now Fox a newscaster, talk show host. There's Anthony Romero of the American Civil Liberties Union, Father Roy Bourgeois,
Jesse Jackson.
Jesse Jackson is in it as well. Yes, there's quite a lineup of folks that are interviewed on various aspects of the Latino migration, including lots of very folks who are not known at all, who came to the country undocumented and who tell their stories, including a brain surgeon at Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Hinojosa, who came here undocumented as a teenager, it's an emotionally gripping film, and I think it's really going to change a lot of minds in terms of an understanding of how the Latino migration to this country occurred.
Well, and you have families where the children are born here, and parents don't have documents, and so you'd be splitting up families if you try and send people back. So it's like we have to come up with some kind of solution.
Well, what we already are, I think there's something like 4,000 children now in some kind of institutional care whose parents in the United States, whose parents have already been deported as a result of the immigration raids and the mass deportations under first the Bush administration and the Obama administration. And luckily, at least in the proposed Senate version of the immigration reform bill by the so-called Gang of Eight, there is a provision in there that any U.S. citizen children who are here in the country whose parents were have been previously deported will have an opportunity to apply to bring their parents back into the country. That's one of the, I think, most positive aspects, little-known aspects of the Senate version that was introduced a couple of weeks ago. But, of course, we still have to see what happens in the House and, of course, whether even this Senate version gets through the Senate. Forget about the House. So it's a long road to reach some kind of comprehensive immigration reform.
But it does seem like a number of Republicans do want to do something about this because they're seeing that they're alienating a huge portion of the population.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's obviously the difference between this year and last year, that around this time last year, all the Republican candidates were trying to outdo themselves in debates over who could be the most the hardest on the country's undocumented, and there's been a 180-degree turn in the Republican Party as a result of the recent elections. When they're facing now the reality that they could be a permanent minority party unless they do something to eat into this huge shift that has occurred among, not only in terms of the growth of the Latino vote, but the overwhelming trend of the Latino vote going more and more Democratic as a result of the Republican Party being seen as the standard bearer of anti-immigrant sentiment. So I think that that's what's propelling the Republicans and is even giving a little backbone to some Democrats who were at, were claiming to be for immigration reform but really weren't fighting very hard for it. Now they're seeing that the climate has changed in the country dramatically.
Well, we've got a few minutes left, Juan. What else would you like to say to encourage people to come out and check this film out?
Well, I think the important thing to also understand is the role of young Latinos in the country and how they're going to have enormous impact for decades to come. I think at one point in the film it's mentioned that there's 500,000 Latinos turning 18 this year and every year for the next 20 years. That the so much of the Latino population is still so young that the real impact of that young population on American society, on both not only in terms of jobs and the economy, but also in terms of politics and voting, has yet to be seen. As big as the impact has grown in the last several years, it's going to grow even bigger in the future. And so I think that that the film tries to present some of the stories of those young Latinos and some of the successes and the problems that they've they're confronting, and also the hope that they represent, that this dreamer generation represents, because the young dreamers of today are very much like the civil rights, the college students who went south to protest and sit in for civil rights in the 60s and 70s. They are really the conscience of their generation in terms of being able to raise issues, uncomfortable issues, for the rest of the society about what human rights and respect and dignity for marginalized and downtrodden people means today in the United States of the 21st century. And I think that that's an important, and I think that it's important for them, because there have been a lot of young people coming out to these showings around the country in Denver and Santa Fe and Albuquerque and Chicago and Detroit, and there's been a lot of these young people who've already been involved in the Dreamer movement, who've been drawing inspiration from the film, which is validating and recognizing their important contribution over the last few years to the immigration debate.
And folks, it is tomorrow night that it starts, and as Juan was saying, it's going to be there for a week. Harvest of Empire is going to be in Houston starting tomorrow evening, May 3rd, at Sundance Cinemas. And the address there is 510 Texas, and that's downtown. And tomorrow night, we're going to have producer Wendy Thompson Marquez. And she's going to be there for the first showing at 7:30, doing a Q&A afterwards, so you definitely want to check that out. Anything else you want to say, Juan, before we let you go?
No, that's good. I just want to urge all the KPFT listeners and those who are followers of Democracy Now! to turn out, and I guarantee you, you're going to be like a emotionally hit two or three times during the full length of the movie.
Juan, thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate it. We've been talking to Juan Gonzalez, and he is the narrator of the film Harvest of Empire, The Untold Story of Latinos in America. And it's based on his book by the same name. And we're going to wrap it up for another week. And I want to thank, I'm going to thank Lillian Kerr for coming in and doing her interview and a bird's eye view. Larry Curzan with the news, and running the board for us this evening, Gordon Anderson. Thank you so much, Gordon, for being there. And folks, we'll see you next week, but we want you to stick around, because coming up next, we got Glenn Urbach and The Other Side. And if you miss any of tonight's show, you can check it out online. Go to archive.kpft.org or go to kpft.org and click on Listen on Demand. And we are on Facebook, Progressive Forum on Facebook. Check that out. We will see you next week, but we better get out of here. Take care. Have a good weekend.
Houston Arts Alliance's Folk Life program, along with Mecca, TBH, and KPFT, present Uno Dos Tres, a three-part concert series showcasing Houston's large and diverse Latino community. Wrapping up the series are Garifuna artists Lumalali, Saturday, May 18th at Fifth Ward Jam, 3705 Lyons Street. A free listening workshop starts at 5 p.m. and a free concert at 6:30. For more info, visit HoustonArtsAlliance.com/folklife.
Progressive Coalition, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, organizes against war while fighting for social and economic justice at home, including the struggle against racism and all forms of discrimination and bigotry. For more details, you can check out AnswerCoalition.org. The Answer Coalition is active in the fight against war abroad and war at home. Cuts to schools, housing, social services, financial aid, and other needs of people often become money for drones, tanks, and military intervention. Answer is active in the fight for justice everywhere. Want to learn more? You can simply learn by visiting AnswerCoalition.org.
Commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.